Welcome to a new year of Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by Community Radio WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill and at WERU.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's episode, we meet Mainers who are accomplished photographers: Chris Labbé, wildlife photographer; Joey Kelly, rail fan and train photographer; and Kevin Johnson, photo archivist of the Penobscot Marine Museum. Welcome, Chris Labbé, wildlife photographer. We're chatting today about the art and craft of photography in Maine. And you and I met while you were working at something quite different from photography. We were both teachers for JMG. But tell us a bit about what you do now and what path brought you to wildlife photography.
So my passion has become wildlife photography, but all my life I've always had a camera in my hand. Back when I was young or before high school, my parents bought me my first camera. So all through my teenage years and my high school years and my college years, I've always had a camera in my hand. And I think what got me into wildlife photography is when I was teaching in South Portland as a principal down at Holy Cross School, I had heard that there was a snowy owl down by the jetport. And so I decided I would be so excited to go see a snowy owl because I'm a birder. And when I was in college, I was a biology and environmental science major. So I always had the birding as part of my repertoire of things I like to do. So I set out with one of my teachers and we went to look for this snowy owl and we found it. It was sitting on top of a rooftop, which they tend to do. And we were so excited to find the snowy owl. And so from then on, it was like wildfire. And so from then on, it was birds, it was snowy owls, it was foxes, it was deer, it was dogs, it was people, it was everything. But it was really, I think, the snowy owl is just a special bird that just really, when you see it, just makes you, it's magical. And I think that was really ignited the, really taking the time to do wildlife photography because it really takes a commitment because you really just don't, you know, walk up and take a picture. A lot of times it's many, many, many hours and many, many days of looking and looking and looking and really not getting anything. And so it really takes commitment and passion to sit in the cold weather or the rainy weather and walk away with nothing. And so it's a lot of hard work, but it's worth it at the end when you actually capture what you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of your bird shots, I think, mostly. You mentioned just now that, you know, you really have to set it up and it takes patience to sit and wait for the conditions to be right. Do you wait for the sky to be the right color behind the bird or the... How do you find your shots and how do you typically set up for them?
A lot of times you don't actually set up for the shot. Sometimes you do. But basically you try to look, you know, you learn the behavior of whatever you're looking for, whether it's a fox or it's a bird, depending on what the bird is. The snowy owl behavior, it could be different than a short ear behavior, which is different than a barred owl behavior. And so you learn their behaviors, you learn their environment. You learn where you think that they are. A lot of times there's a lot of birders put their where they find where the different birds are, and so you do some research and you might know that, let's say that there's a big field where there's particular birds have hung out, and so you might go and sit on that field for a couple hours, hoping that the bird that was seen yesterday may show up today. And you could sit there for 4 hours and it doesn't show up. And you could do that for like 3 or 4 days in a row and it doesn't show up. And the next day you go somewhere else, and that day that bird shows up in that field and you missed it. So there's no rhyme or reason, and you just hedge your bets, and sometimes you're lucky and your research panned out, and sometimes it didn't. But you try to line up your best thoughts and you take all your research and you try to be where you think that they're going to be.
And so do you have to take multiple shots before you get
Oh, yeah.
your money shot, so to speak?
You know what? I would say you never, for me, you never have the perfect shot, because even though you have a great shot, you always want the better shot that keeps you going out. And so
Okay.
some of these new cameras, they take 20, 30, 40 frames per second.
Oh my
Per
gosh.
second. So when you go to look at all your pictures, you're looking at many, many, many pictures when you go to post-process your pictures. And so a lot of the time is when you want to catch a bird in flight, that's why those 20 frames per second or 30 frames per second are really important, because when the bird's going to take flight, if you miss it, you miss it. And so those 20 frames per second, you really have to watch, and you try to start to take that picture before the bird takes off, because it takes off very quickly. And if you're not ready, you've missed it. But you could have really great shots, but there's always a better one, and you're always in search for that better shot. So you're always out there taking it, looking for the next best shot, because you're never happy until you get your better shot, because you always know there's a better one that you want to get. You're always looking for it. It's
Oh
always
boy,
a
it's
better
almost
shot.
like music. It's like a monkey on your back.
Yep, it's all, yep. You always want to get you to satisfy yourself. You know that you can get a better shot.
Do you ever t publish like series if from these multiple shots per second? Can you publish a series of, say, a bird's takeoff, or does
You
that make
can. I do
sense?
that. There's some really, really great photographer friends. You really network, and so there's a network with a group of photographers. I network with some really, really great photographers who have done some, tremendous shots like that, where they can publish, the very series of, before they take off to the takeoff all the way to the end.
Yeah.
And people are now even have really mastered the art of videography. With the digital cameras, and it's really a tremendous skill. And so there's, it's always the next thing that's coming up, and people have really done a really nice job. Even on Facebook, and there's all those different groups that people can join. There's tons of bird groups, and people can watch on those bird groups to see just the tremendous talent that people have to capture all kinds of animals and birds and landscape. It's just the cameras out there are amazing, and the people that, can master them are really, really talented.
Wow. Well, we're lucky in Maine in that we have quite a bit of fodder for wonderful photography.
Yes.
Is it, so your photography is mostly digital, right?
Yes.
At this point.
Yeah, they're all, most of them, we use mirrorless cameras. They're the new. Not so new now, but most photographers that do it most often, and professional photographers, I would say most of them are using mirrorless cameras. And a lot of the camera companies, Canon, Nikon, all those Sony cameras, they're not supporting their old DSLR cameras there. So you're really using their mirrorless cameras. Even the lenses that were used for the older cameras are not being. They're slowly not supporting them, although they're still out there. So you can buy the older cameras and the older lenses that are still good. They're just not supported by them. And so the whole mirrorless cameras and lenses that are, pretty nice price tag on them, but they're the new cameras that are coming out that are just they're incredible. They're incredible what they can capture and the clarity as well. They're really good.
Do you think in terms of learning to be a photographer, do you think that there's any real purpose anymore in learning the old school reflex camera dark room situation, or do you think that's not necessary to develop an eye as a photographer anymore?
I always wanted to learn how to use develop things in a dark room. I just never had that opportunity. So I think if you always have that opportunity, I do know some people that still old school still use the film cameras and still like to develop their own photos. I think that knowing what the light is and how you use it and that your shutter speed and your light and the look of where how you want to put your environment and where you want to put your subject. I mean, all that is important. And so anybody can, most people can pick up a camera and take a picture and that's, and they'll come out with a pretty decent picture. But I think all the other things that will make a better picture are important and do take some time to sort of figure it out. Anything from you figure out your own camera. It's like your car or anything that's important. You know your own camera, so you know what shutter speed works best for your camera in combination of what your ISO is or what the best light is or how what the quirks are and stuff. So
Sure.
all the mechanical things are important to figure out how they work. And then you have to have a good eye to figure out, is it too dark that I don't even want to try to take it, or is the environment a good environmental shot? Do you put the subject in the right corner or the left corner or high or low? Like all those things, it takes time in the field. Like I'm a skier, and so I always say you get to a point where you're teaching people, and I always say a lot of it is just time on the snow to get better. And I think in photography, a lot of it is time in the field. You just have to put time in the field. I can't tell you how long that I've spent time in the field from being probably age 13 to like age 65. There's tremendous amount of time in the field. I just think you make a lot of mistakes, you miss a lot of shots, and you go back, next time you go out and you hopefully don't make the same mistake, but you miss a lot of good shots and you get a lot of good shots, but
Sure.
you learn a lot depending on where you are. And there's people all around you that you can ask questions to, and people are better than you, and you help people and they help you. So it's really a nice community, and you do learn a lot. And it's a great excuse to be outside, especially in the wintertime. And for
Yes.
somebody that doesn't like to necessarily do a lot of exercise, you'd be surprised at how many tens of thousands of steps that you take when you're looking for animals and birds and stuff in the snow, in the rain, and all those things. It's just nice to be outside.
Well, one very exciting aspect of your photography, Chris, is the connection between Maine and Zimbabwe. Can you explain that?
So I feel very lucky is that I've been traveling to Zimbabwe for probably 11 plus years. And the way that started is I went with a friend who was speaking at a conference in South Africa in Cape Town. And from there we went over to Zimbabwe just as to go on a safari. We were both educators. And so when we were over there, we met up with a school there and found out that there were a lot of children that were basically being sent home from the school because they hadn't paid their tuition. And we found out that their tuition was $10. And
Oh,
so
wow.
we were th thinking that you'd go to Starbucks and spend $10 on one cup of coffee. The short version is from a grassroots effort, I started supporting these communities and raising money. And so when we would get donations, I decided that if people were given donations and we agreed on the project with the villages of Zimbabwe, I needed to go back to make sure that the money that was given was really used for the project that we agreed upon.
Sure.
So that I would go over and take the pictures, I would be in the pictures, and I could send it to the people so they would know that the money was going to the right place. So in the meantime, when I was over there, I went on safari. And so from then on, I had the best of both worlds because now not only could I was I helping the villages and creating this family unit over there, I was taking pictures of the wildlife that was over in Africa that I truly have developed a special place in my heart for, the people of Zimbabwe, the animals. I think my favorite animals ever growing up probably was a lion. And so seeing those lions and lion cubs and just seeing the animals of Africa like close up to you for real is just one of those things that you can't describe until you see them. And so I feel very lucky. But then again, I have to say, I always am after the best shot. Even after 11 plus years, I always like, where is my favorite shot? Took me 11 years to get it. Is I always wanted the shot of the mother lioness carrying the baby lion in her mouth, that you see in all those movies. And after 11 plus years, last year I was able to get that shot, and it's just one of my favorite shots. And you remember where you are and who you're with and what you do. Almost in every shot that I've taken after 11 years, I can remember every place that I was at.
That's
It's
amazing.
quite exciting, quite exciting. And now I take people with me to go so that, most of my photographers in New England, one way or the other in the last, 11 years and have gone with me. And it's just one of those exciting things to be able to do. Yeah.
Is that part of your plan for the new year to go back or?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm going back with five different groups and 20 people that will go back with me this year. And I would say over the past 11 years, we probably have raised over, $500,000 to support the communities over there. Yeah. I'm
That's
really proud, very
tremendous.
proud of that. Yeah,
You
very proud
should
of that.
be. That's
Yeah. Yeah.
quite an effort.
Yeah.
So, where can Creative Maine listeners find examples of your work, both Maine animals and African animals?
I have an Instagram profile, which is wildlife. Underscore by underscore Chris, wildlife by Chris on the Instagram. Then I have a Facebook, just my personal page that everything shows up for, which is, Chris LeBay, but there's so many Chris LeBays, it's kind of hard to find,
By the way, I will link in the archives
Wildlife by Chris.
Wildlife by Chris. I'll link that
Yeah.
on the WERU.org archives.
That's awesome.
Okay,
Yeah.
Wildlife by
That's
Chris.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of there's yeah, that's probably the that's where you'll see all the different pictures, yeah.
Okay, are your pictures ever for sale?
I just usually give them away. I don't sell them. I just feel like, if somebody wanted them, I would, I usually just give them the print. I mean, I give them the file, and then they can decide what they want to do with them, because there's all kinds of stuff out there. You can get metal prints or canvas prints or 5x7s or 8, you can do whatever you want with them. So I just, well, I'm just thrilled that somebody would want one. And so I'm more than happy just to, give them to somebody so they can enjoy them.
Well, maybe there's a book in your future. Who
No, I
knows?
don't think so. I give that away too.
Well, listen, Chris LaBey, I am so grateful that you decided to come on Creative Maine with us. And thank you for your generosity and your talent. And I hope to speak with you again. Have a wonderful 2026.
Right, and you as well. Happy 2026 to everybody listening.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. Ten Buck Theater will present Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, February 12th through 22nd at the Cyrus Pavilion at the University of Maine at Orono. For more information, visit tenbuckstheater.org. On Sunday, February 1st, Bagaduce Music presents Frigg, a Nordic string septet at the Bay School Emlyn Hall in Blue Hill. For more information, visit bagaducemusic.org. Every Monday morning from 10 to 12 a.m., the Witherly Fiber Group meets at the Witherly Memorial Library in Castine for fiber arts and friendship. For more information, call the library at 207-326-4375. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. Now we speak with Joey Kelly, rail fan and train photographer. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and on WERU.org. Welcome, Joey Kelly, or should I say welcome back to Creative Maine. You are so far the only person that I've featured twice on Creative Maine. Yes, you have that distinction. We featured Joey Kelly and the Eastern Maine Model Railroad Club in the November episode, but he's back here for a very different skill, very different reason. We're going to be talking about his train spotting and nighttime train photography, which is very unusual, to say the least. So you are a train spotter and a photographer, as well as a model railroader. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you came to be in the photography biz.
Well, okay. Thanks for having me back, by the way. And by the way, that only means that I want to come back for a third time. So let's see if we can come up with a three-peat here.
Okay.
A bit about myself. I had been interested in model trains since I was a kid. Took many years away from the railroad hobby in general. Just, you know, life happens. And towards the end of my senior year of high school, actually about halfway through, I had a very bad case of senioritis, as they call it.
Yep.
And I had a lot of study halls. It was a very light semester, my second semester. And I had an awful lot of unfettered access to the internet. And when you start doing that, you start browsing around and looking at things. And what actually triggered the re-interest in railroads in general was the news that the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad had gone into bankruptcy. And that happened in 2001. And again, lined up with my senior year of high school. And I wasn't aware, quite frankly, completely ignorant as to the number of people, thousands literally, around the world that were interested in the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad specifically. And more than ignorant as to the number of people worldwide that are interested in railroads, main railroading, model railroading, you know, all of these different subfacets. So from that one event sort of triggered a passion in me, in that I said to myself, someone needs to get out here and photograph this railroad before it passes into history. And that was the goal. Get it before it's gone. In that aspect, I sort of took a documentary style of photography almost by instinct more than anything. You know, get pictures of everything. And I'm glad that I did that, because a lot of what most people would say, well, the lighting isn't that good, or the shadow's bad, or what are you taking a picture of that for? That's not very interesting. A lot of that is now scrapped, or no longer available, or repainted, or buildings have been knocked down. So a lot of that stuff that I shot early, and a lot of people gave me crap for shooting, frankly, because they're going, what are you doing that? That is always going to be there. Well, not guess so. What? It's not always going to be there. And that really fueled my passion for this. And by the way, train spotter, by the way, is the British term, more and somewhat European. The term in America is rail fam.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so heads up.
Good,
but And the two are not synonymous exactly, and the two are do one implies railfan implies photographer, but it's not always the case. There are people out here that don't do anything with photographs that are, consider themselves railfans. So it's a multifaceted hobby.
Yes, well, you are known not only for your rail photography, but also your nighttime shots. So let's talk a little bit about the nighttime shots. Who or what was your inspiration for this kind of photography?
Well, ironically, it goes back to that initial 2001 inspiration. A gentleman by the name of O. Winston Link passed in 2001, and the news in those days was a little slower than it is now, and things didn't quite get around as fast, and there were a lot of people still in the end of 2001 doing tributes and talking about him, even though he had passed in January of that year. And some of the first images that, as a person stepping back into this interest, that some of the very first images that I saw were O. Winston Link's images. And O. Winston Link was a commercial photographer out of New York State, but he is probably going to go down in history as the man who photographed the Norfolk and Western Railroad under steam, primarily at night in the late 1950s. And early 60s. He both before his death and after his death, books have been published on his work, and they are some of the most prized books in my photography book collection. The man was an inspiration to not only myself, but many. There are thousands around the world that can trace their interest in night photography, specifically back to his stuff, because he was doing something that was completely different and off the wall and completely insane, not to mention inexpensive in the 1950s. He was building custom-built lighting panels with flash bulbs in them and running literally hundreds, if not thousands, of feet of electrical cable to fire these flash bulbs to provide enough light to freeze frame moving trains at night. So he's freezing the moment in action. The trains are absolutely stationary. To put out that amount of light in the 1950s required an incredible effort. He had an assistant that went with him. They had to, and he wasn't just doing this at the local station. There are some of his most famous photos involved him literally building rope bridges to cross rivers in order to put lights on the other side of rivers to focus back on the tracks. The man was incredible. His efforts in, like I say, inspired so many people, not just myself, because this was some of the first photography I'd actually seen. It had probably a little bit more of a overriding influence on what I wanted to do. It was also difficult, which appeals to me. I like a little bit of a challenge.
That sounds
And
like
had
a
I
lot of a challenge.
Well, if I'd known then what I know now, a little bit might have been a lot. It was so different from anything that anybody else was doing, and he, the volume that he did and the creative angles that he did, he used light to hide and emphasize elements in the photos. Other people do it with colors, other people do it with by moving the camera 3 feet to the left or 2 feet to the right or whatever to hide something. He just would put light on it if he wanted to see it and not put light on it if he didn't.
And of course, this is all black and white.
Yes, this is although he did actually shoot color later, as a lot of people from the 50s did. They made a transition. But when he was cutting his teeth on commercial photography, even actually well into the 60s, most commercial photography was done in black and white because of reproduction costs. Most of his work, the famous stuff, is all black and white.
So, how does this translate to the Joey Kelly photographs of today?
Well, it's more of inspiration than it is of direct translation.
Sure.
What he was doing in the 50s with flash bulbs, I do with electronic flash units. either very small portable ones that are powered by batteries or much larger ones that are actually running off of traditional house current, traditional power, which I have to bring even larger batteries into the field to power when I'm not near a power source. But what he did was show people that this could be done. Not necessarily specifically how to do XYZ shot, but how that this was possible and the dramatic effect that you could get out of it and how to use light to emphasize and de-emphasize elements.
So, is
And
that also how you catch your speeding target?
yes, it is. The difference is, again, I'm using much larger, more powerful electronic flash units, and there's less of them. But the technique really isn't all that different. If you wanted to give it a term, it would be artificially lit night photography, meaning you're
Okay.
bringing artificial lights into the scene and lighting it, not unlike a portrait session or a commercial product photo session, except for the scale. Some of the night photos that I have done are hundreds of feet deep or wide, depending on how one measures it. And I'm anywhere from 10, that would be extremely close, actually. I'm usually 25 to 150 feet away from where the train is. So I'm using radio slaves to communicate with the lights that tell the lights when to fire. And that's a technique that was not available in the 50s.
No.
And always, Mr. Link was running cables everywhere to accomplish the same thing. As a result, I can do a similar looking shot much quicker with much less effort. But the inspiration is still from him.
Sure. So have you ever, arranged a perfect setup? You've got your lights, you've got your all, you've got the scene, you've got everything, you've got your body in the chair, and have you ever then missed the shot?
Oh, yes. It is so heartbreaking when that happens. It's happened for a variety of reasons. You're going out there, there's so many things that have to work exactly correctly for the shot to come off correctly. I have a shot that I am proud of, but not proud of. If you know the area in Bangor going towards Hamden around McLaughlin Seafood, which has been there for many, 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 many years. There's a spot there called the Tin Bridge, which is a locally known landmark. It's a very old railroad bridge. I went down there, set up the shot. This shot is probably one of the longest ones I have ever done. It was close to 1,000 feet from one end to the other. And the lights were all set up perfect. Everything was perfect. The timing was working. The test shots all looked good. And when the train showed up, the middle light of the three just didn't flash.
Oh.
Oh, I was sick almost literally to my stomach when I realized that. And of course, you can't just hit reset and do it again because the train is moving, the train is running on someone else's schedule, and you can't just get on a radio and yell at them and go, "Hey, come back." That's not,
Yeah,
you
back
know.
up and let me take that
Yeah,
again.
would you mind stopping, backing up for 22 miles and giving it another go? No, you can't just do that.
So it didn't work out, but I'm sure you got enough that did work out.
Oh yeah, for every failure, you realize why you like your successes
Yes,
so much.
exactly. Well, do you ever photograph the model railroads?
Yes, I do, actually.
And you can make them look sufficiently like the real thing?
Well, yes, I think so. I call them faux night photos because, of course, you're in a building. You don't really have a nighttime in a building. You just shut the lights off. But I do use the techniques that I've developed over the years for the night photos of real things. The kicker is that although the trains are smaller, the lights are actually not smaller. So you can turn down the power on them, but at some point you reach a minimum amount of power that you can get out of the light. And light, like I say, doesn't scale. So you have a flash that is proportionately bigger than the object that you're trying to photograph. It's actually easier because, of course, it's repeatable because you have, the set in front of you all done, and you can move things and tweak things. And of course, it's just sitting there waiting for you, so you're not having to do it while moving. And as a result, you can take your time. And it's actually easier sometimes to just put the camera on a tripod, open the shutter up, and just hit things with a flashlight and do it that way.
Interesting. Okay. So is your photography all digital, Joey? Do you ever work in a dark room to get special effects, or is that all like Photoshop?
I am proud to say that I have never once been in a dark room with my own photography. I'm a child, if that's the right word, of the digital age.
Sure.
It's sort of awkward phrasing,
A
but the
product of the
product,
digital.
a product. There we go. That's it. I'm a product of the digital age. I like that. I'm going to start using that. All of the serious photography that I've ever done has been digital. Of course, as the technology's gotten better, as I've gotten better, as my digital darkroom, aka Photoshop and Lightroom and all the other things have gotten better, what I can do is just gotten phenomenal. The technique that we have, the hardware that we have now, combined with the software that we have now, images are can be made that are absolutely stunning.
Fantastic. So, where can our Creative Maine listeners find you, your books, your online magazines? Yes, your photography in various forms.
Everything can be found linked off of Joey, Joey, Kelly, Kellely, photo, photo.com. You'll find links to everything there. You'll find stuff on my Facebook page by the same name, joeykellyphoto.com. It's best to probably follow me there, honestly, and you'll find various things. I mean, I don't just do the nighttime photography. I recently did a photo shoot of some food at a local restaurant. So there's all kinds of things up there on joeykellyphoto.com and the Facebook page.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming back on Creative Maine with me. This is so interesting. Of course, I love the railroad aspect, but this is a photography show. So thank you so much and have a wonderful and productive 2026.
Thanks for having me, and you have a wonderful 2026 as well.
Thank you. Welcome, Kevin Johnson, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad you decided to come on the show with us. You are the photo archivist at the Penobscot Marine Museum. And can you describe your job to us? What is a photo archivist?
Well, a photoarchivist, I would say, is the same as any archivist, except what we archive is primarily photographs or different photographic objects. We have one of the largest, if not the largest, photography collection in the state. And that involves organizing those various collections that make up this archive, often rehousing them in protective envelopes and boxes so that they will last as long as they can. In this modern age, we're digitizing them and able to make them available through our online platform. We produce a lot of exhibits and also provide a lot of images to people who are telling their stories, whether they be filmmakers or authors or writers or just lovers of photography or genealogy that are exploring family roots or places of origin.
So how long have you been in this position, and what led you here?
Well, it's an interesting question and a story that I've gotten a lot of mileage out of. I started at the museum in 2007, and believe it or not, it was never my intention to, when I was a kid, to grow up and be a photo archivist. I don't think I even knew that those positions existed, frankly.
No.
But what happened was I was very much interested in photography ever since high school. Spent many years trying to learn on my own, reading Ansel Adams books and building a dark room and doing those steps. And at some point it became apparent to me that I needed to go to school because I just kept hitting walls that I couldn't figure out on my own. And I had the opportunity to go to the Maine Photographic Workshops in 2003. And I did their year-long program in traditional wet darkroom photography. And then for the next 2 years, I was a teaching assistant there, doing that same program. So it was a really great creative bubble. I was in my happy place making art. And I've always been interested in history and historical photos. But one day when I went into the school's library, in fact, most of the time when I went into the photographic workshop's library, the librarian would have these boxes of glass plate negatives on her desk that she was inventorying. And I was kind of curious, just being curious of nature. But one day I went in and she had all the boxes that she had on her desk had the place Greensboro, Vermont labeled on the end of them. And Greensboro, Vermont is a tiny little place up in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont that is made up of a lake, an inn, and a general store, and that's it. Here there were like six boxes of glass plates all of this town. And I had been going there for a couple of weeks every summer with my family for our family vacations. And I couldn't imagine what all these images were of. So being at the workshops, I was able to take them into the dark room. I was able to enlarge them and print them. And I was very much smitten by the images that appeared. They were part of this collection of the Eastern Illustrating and Publishing Company, which was a postcard manufacturer that was based in Belfast that photographed not just Belfast or Waldo County, but all of Maine and all of New England and even towns down to Florida with this big business plan of photographing the entire United States.
Wow.
They never pulled that off, but this archive that the Maine Photo Workshops owned at the time was made up at that about 35,000 of these glass plate negatives, each one 5x7, representing all these different towns and villages around New England. And as fate would have it, the librarian who had been working on that collection was leaving and set it up that I could take over what she was doing, which I soon learned was to figure out how to make money off the collection because the school was in some financial trouble. The recession had hit. They wanted to be able to license images and sell reproductions. So after spending all these years in the wet dark room, I had to pivot and learn the whole digital world, which I had been trying to avoid. But I had some great friends at the workshops who taught me how to digitize glass plates. Started a database of what we had and spent the next 2 years cataloging and beginning to digitize this collection. During that time, the recession really hit. The school was foreclosed upon and we all lost our jobs. And in February of 2007, while I had plans to have friends over to watch the Super Bowl, I got a call from one of my friends in Rockport who said the pipes had burst in that building and the whole collection was soaking wet and they were going to throw it away. And I needed to do something. So I got my friends to come with me down to Rockport that night instead of watching the football game. And we spent the evening pulling all these glass plates out of the basement of Union Hall up to the dining hall of the school, which was the only heated building on campus. It was a really grim scene. Each box that we held up had to wait for the water to drain out of it. It was freezing. And so I got up there and I made some calls to the Eastman House and RIT and learned that all was not lost. The glass plates could get wet. They just needed to dry. But the asterisk was they couldn't dry touching another negative or in these archival envelopes that I had been putting them in, or they would stick to the emulsion and permanently damage them. So I figured out a way of keeping everything wet by wrapping it all in plastic and then over the next 5 weeks, dried out the collection on in plate racks, actually. And during that time, the school closed. The school was sold to a nonprofit group which calls themselves Maine Media Workshops, that still runs that place today. And the collection was donated to the Penobscot Marine Museum with the only condition that they take me with the collection and give me a job here.
Wow. So Penobscot Marine Museum had not had anything to do with photography, particularly before then.
That's not true. They actually had some amazing collections, but they didn't have a huge photographic collection. They had Joanna Coulcord's Sea Captain's Daughter collection. They had Ruth Montgomery Sea Captain Daughter collection. And then the year before this happened, they, with a donation from Linda Bean, acquired a collection by a photographer named Red Boutelier. And actually, I'm sorry, Linda Bean helped to finance the processing of the collection, but the friends of the museum were able to purchase this archive of a journalist, Red Boutelier, and all of his 4x5 negatives of a lot of boat building stuff along the Maine coast in the 50s and the 60s and 70s. So they had this big collection that they just got about 20,000 negatives. They probably had 5 or 6,000 other negatives in different collections. And then they got me along with 35,000 of these glass plate negatives.
But you can
I
get
realized that they
wet.
had something special in it, and they did. You know, all of a sudden it was a unique opportunity for the museum to expand in a way that they maybe hadn't realized that they could have early on. But now it's definitely become a significant part of the museum. You know, it contributes obviously to all the exhibits that we have on campus based on themes and that type of thing. But it also has a life of its own, and it will, in a way, of being a research repository for these photographic images. And what I've been trying to do as photoarchivist and steward of this collection is to make them available so that they can be used to tell stories and illustrate books, movies, magazines, websites, because that's what they're for.
Well, it's tremendous, and the collection spans pretty much the entire history of photography, right?
They do. I mean, we don't have a ton of the really earliest stuff, but we do have our fair share of daguerreotypes, other early process photographs. We're especially strong on a couple themes of fishing and boat building. And one of the things that I really love about our archive is that all these collections have different points of view based on the photographer who made them. So whether it's a ship captain's daughter who is going across the oceans and seeing countries that no one her age has seen before and learning this new technology, or it's a seasoned photojournalist who is, you know, working on a story that he or she is writing and needs good images to accompany it. And that's a different point of view. A postcard company approaches their subjects with their own point of view. And they're all different and biased in a way, but illuminating in a way.
They're probably not thinking, oh, I'm making a historical record.
Exactly. Now you're totally right. I would say that maybe a couple of the photojournalists knew that they might have archives that would live on past them. For example, Kosti Rahoma, who is, I would say, one of Maine's most well-known photographers and photographed for Life magazine and many other of the big magazines in the 40s and the 50s.
Isn't he connected with the Wyeths pretty closely?
He was very good friends with Andrew Wyeth and photographed Andrew many times, and even went on a few adventures with Andy, artistic adventures, if you will. And so, yes, he was definitely connected with the Wyeths. And in fact, Andy Wyeth wrote the introduction to Kosti's posthumous photograph book called Night Train at Wiscasset Station.
Wow. So I find it very interesting that these photographs have sort of memorialized places and technologies and customs and objects no longer in use, which of course was not the intention at the time. But tell us about some of the interesting locals. You talked about young women who accompanied their fathers on sea journeys.
Yeah, we have three sea captains' daughters who
Excuse
learned
me.
photography at the turn of the century. These were Joanna Colquhart, whose father was Sears Court's most famous sea captain, Captain Lincoln Colquhart, who commanded the State of Maine, a big ship at the time. We have Ruth Montgomery, who's was based out of Booth Bay, in East Booth Bay, I should say, and went to sea with her parents, mostly to South America. And then we also have Harriet Hichborn, who did not go to sea, but her father was a ship captain and ship builder in Stockton Springs. She learned photography and made real photo postcards and hand-colored photo postcards, both of her own and for at least one other photographer that I'm aware of. And that was a popular thing to do right around 1900 and 1910, was to using these oil color paints to paint in black and white real photo postcards. They're quite beautiful.
Well, in watching the other interview that you sent me when we were preparing for our interview, there were towns in Maine that were memorialized that now no longer exist, and when you went to find it, it was
Bend in
just
the
a
road.
wide spot in the road.
And other towns which I can't visit, like Flagstaff, which was is up in northern Maine and was essentially they needed a reservoir and they dammed the Dead River and flooded the entire town of Flagstaff, so it doesn't exist anymore. So apparently if you go scuba diving, you can find the cellar holes of the various houses that were on Main Street there. So it
Wow.
really does capture a period of time, and each one is specific to a period of time.
So currently, photographers, some of the other people that we're interviewing on this program, use primarily digital
Sure.
technology. And but the people you had alluded to these glass plates that couldn't get wet and so forth. So can you explain some of that early technology to us? How did those cameras actually work?
Sure. So it is all essentially film, and all film is a medium to hold silver nitrate in a way that it can be exposed to light and capture an image. So when photography was being invented, which took a long time, they figured out that light passing through a small hole will create a scene upside down and backwards, which essentially is a camera obscura. And for years, painters used those to trace the landscape or be able to create perspective. But they always wanted to figure out how to keep the image. And they finally were able to first figure out a way that silver was light sensitive and would capture an image, but then they couldn't figure out how to save it because as soon as the light hit it again, it would disappear. And then they invented Fixer, which allowed them to save it. So now they had the means to preserve an image and the mediums at the time that did not include plastic. So it was first it was paper and then copper, like copper plates that would be polished, and then you could put the silver nitrate on that. And then glass came into play. And so for a while in the mid-1800s, glass was the medium to put silver nitrate on and make a photograph. Early on, they were wet plates, meaning the light sensitive solution would be poured onto the plate, covered, put into the camera, exposed, and then put into the developer all before that emulsion dried. So a photographer had to have their dark room right with them. And this is what was Matthew Brady, think Matthew Brady during the Civil War, that's what he was doing. Long exposures. If you were making someone's portrait, they even had things that would hold their head in place so you wouldn't move during like 30-second exposure or something.
It's a
But
long
that's
time if you've ever had to sit for 30 seconds.
Oh, can you imagine? And that's why so many of those pictures are not completely sharp, where they show some blur. But over time, they figured out how to make that faster and preserve it. And they came up with what was called the dry plate negative. So these were glass plates. And when I say glass plates, I'm talking literally a window pane. And they came in the various sizes of window panes. You could get 3 inches by 5 inches, or 4 inches by 5 inches, or 5 inches by 7 inches. All the way up to 16 inches by 20 inches. And they had a camera that would hold one of these plates. But at this point, they could put the emulsion on and dry it and put it in a light tight box. And then photographers could take those plates and put them into film holders, all keeping them unexposed at this point, which could then be inserted into a view camera or a box camera, which is the type of camera with the bellows and you would get underneath a dark cloth to look through. And make the exposure and then put a dark slide back in and be able to take that film out of the camera and bring it back home later and process it in your dark room. That changed a lot. So yeah, shorter exposures, you didn't need to have your dark room with you, which freed people to go out and make photographs. And that's when postcards started to come into play. Postcards essentially were just contact prints on photographic postcard stock. I should say, I want to make this difference. Real photo postcards are actually postcards that are photographs on postcard stock. There were many other postcards that were printed, mass printed, mostly in Germany, on presses, and they were typically lithographs and half tone type prints. But these glass plate negatives, when they made them, they were contact prints of a negative of that same size. So the detail was incredible. It was the next best thing to having the negative, if you will. They were sharp, they were clear, captured the people, the places, the signs, as they were.
That's very interesting. And big business, as I understand it.
And big business, though often
Yes.
the real photo postcard makers weren't big business. They were usually an individual that would be doing them in their basement or bathroom, with the exception of this Eastern Illustrating and Publishing Company, which went mass scale and tried to photograph the entire country.
That's crazy. So, how can our Creative Maine listeners access your beautiful photographs, your interesting archives? How can students engage in research using this archive? Where do they find you?
I would first say, whenever you can, come visit us at the museum. Our exhibits are open from Memorial Day weekend into the middle of October. And during the week, our visitors that come are welcome to come into the photo archives and interact with myself and my fellow archivist, Matt Wheeler, and our volunteers that are typically here manning different workstations that are either digitizing or cataloging our photos. We also have a robust website that has an online database that features about 100,000 of our photographs, with more being added all the time. This is a work in progress, and we've recently switched to a new database platform, which has had some growing pains associated with it, but we're working past those now, and we're pretty proud of how it's turning out. We produce exhibits that go out into different places in Maine. We typically have an exhibit in Camden every April for Maritime Month. I do a lot of talks around the state, and the talks are typically focused around one of our collections. Often it's the Eastern Illustrating Company, but not always. We have a few different publications of our photos. I have a new photo book that's coming out early this year on using the glass plate negatives as a then, and I took modern photographs from the same vantage point. So it's a then and now book of the Booth Bay region.
Oh.
So a bunch of different ways to tap into our photos.
Okay,
We
so give
do
us
work with
a,
schools,
yeah.
and teachers have reached out to us and had projects in mind that they've been able to use our photos for.
Great, so give us a URL for the museum.
So it's pretty simple, www.penobscotmarinemuseum.org. When you land on our website, there is a menu in the upper right. One of your choices is the digital museum, and that gets you to our online database where you can search by keyword or go into an advanced search and search by collection. And then we have an overview page that lists our major collections with descriptions and short slideshows. And we
Very
also have a
good.
YouTube channel that features many of our talks and other things related to photos. So,
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. Go, everyone, and give these remarkable photographs a look.
Adina, thanks so much for having me, and really appreciate it.
Thank you so much to my interesting guests, Chris LaBey, Joey Kelly, and Kevin Johnson. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org. For another eclectic episode on Thursday, February 19th at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when we will learn about why we find poking fun at 19th century bureaucrats so engaging. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson wishing you a warm winter season and a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.